Hello and welcome to the new and improved Writer's Block. Now, we may have lost a K in the transition onto Countercurrents. We are now streaming on Countercurrents DLive, which is to say the Writer's Block is now part of the extended Countercurrents network. Not that we weren't before, and we have Echo, which means we are live on DLive and Odyssey. Odyssey, of course, is that newfangled site where everyone seems to be flocking to because, hey, who knows how long we have here on DLive, because, you know, they've intimated in the past, hey, we're gonna drain these people for all we can, and then we're going to dump them. Well, we're not going to be treated like that. We have a place to retreat to. That's always positive. So I just want to welcome you again if you're just joining us. This is the new and improved Writer's Block. And like I said, we may have lost a K in the transition. Now it's spelled B-L-O-C. It's Le Writer's Block, or so I'm told they say in France when they're not speaking in their own language, in just in their stupid accent. No offense to the French people. I do adore them. They are a wonderful example of European civilization. And here with me, I have Greg Johnson, editor-in-chief of Countercurrents. And for the next hour and a half, we'll see how long we're going to take it, he's going to be helping me launch this new show and put it on the road. And hopefully we can help advance the cause of white nationalism, white well-being, and the broader dissident right. Greg, welcome.
It's great to be on. I always liked the name Writer's Block. And when you said that you were going to do a stream exploring a new direction for the show, I got in touch and I said, well, let me propose a new direction for the show. Let me propose that you bring it on as another Countercurrents radio stream, because we have a few thousand followers on various platforms. And it would be an opportunity to highlight more of our writers. And I've decided to do that myself with my own Sunday live streams. So we're going to be having Roger Devlin on, for instance, tomorrow, as well as Martin Lichtmetz, who's an Austrian writer and who's written a very interesting book on ethno-pluralism that Devlin reviewed. But we have so many other great writers. I thought, why not have a Saturday show that is dedicated to Countercurrents writers and whoever we want to have on as guests as well, and the topics that come up? And who better to host than Nick Gilby, who is one of our most valued writers. So anyway, I just thought it was a natural evolution for the Writer's Block, and Nick agreed. So this is what we're going to do.
Well, it's a good thing you jumped in with that idea when you did, Greg, because otherwise I would have just live streamed myself shaving, which is going to happen later in September. For those of you who may not know, I don't think I've mentioned it before, this beard is a part of a bet that I cannot grow a massive boyar beard within a year, and that was last September. We all did some crazy things during the coronavirus lockdown. I just grew a beard. And today we have decided to let's fire this thing off, because it's going to be a show about writers, about countercurrents writers in particular. Let's start it off with Scattershot, the best that Countercurrents has produced in the past week. Now, you know, there's always debate. What's the best? What's good? What's bad? So I exercised a little editorial judgment, you could say, a little host's privilege. And so I picked mostly the articles from Countercurrents, which I consider to be the most important in the long run for our cause as members of the dissident right. And
one thing, I'd like to toss this out there. Folks, if you want to ask questions, you can do that in the DLive chat, or you can also go to entropystream /.countercurrents and leave it there. So that would be great. This is one way that we can actually raise funds with credit cards. It's the one way. We have been cut off from the global credit card processing industry, but you can do this through Entropy. So if you'd like to do that and take part in the conversation tonight, please go ahead and do that. And we'll post the link to Entropy in the chat here. 1 second. So it's entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen. There's a green button that says leave paid chat. We're not online there. We're not streaming through Entropy, but you can leave your chat and your questions. So we would very much appreciate it. So anyway, take it away, Nick.
Thanks for reminding us, Greg. Where would I would be without you? I'd probably, who knows? I'd be shaving my beard live on this thing. Anyway, so we have decided to talk a little bit about the Best of Countercurrents, which was published this week. So we have here a selection of several articles, the first of which is one written by Stephen Paul Foster called The New Normal 2.0. Now, for those of you who have not read it, and I would appreciate it if the moderators could post the link in the DLive chat. And let me see, I can post it in the Odyssey chat myself for those of us watching on Odyssey. Okay. And it's an article about all the ways in which the world, but especially in America, has changed in the past year, that there is indeed a new normal influenced not only by the measures imposed due to the coronavirus pandemics, you know, if we're still calling it a coronavirus pandemic or whatever, but also by the Black Lives Matters riots and the theft, you know, we are not streaming on DLive, so we can just outright say it, the outright theft of the United States elections away from Donald Trump. And of course, there's a small teaser at the end about the hint of a possibility of a new normal 3.0, which has been effectuated by, you know, our friends in the Central Asia region. Now, Greg, what really struck me as I was reading this article is that Stephen Paul Foster is describing all of the things you yourself outlined at the as the three major events of the year 2020. You think he was channeling you there?
No, I think that everybody who's been watching basically agrees that the major events of 2020 were exactly those three: the pandemic, the BLM, and Antifa rioting, and the stolen election. That's what every one of us was watching in horror for the better part of last year.
Yeah, I think we are still, as they say, you know, the thing about politics is, you know, nothing happens for years and then years happen in weeks. And 2020 was one of those marquee years, one of those years which go down in infamy in the history of politics. And I tend to agree with Stephen Paul Foster that we've still not yet seen the full implications of 2020. I think that it is still with us. In many ways, I mean, it feels like that year never really ended, because this year, the year of our Lord 2021, is so much like it, with lockdowns. Everyone's still obsessing over the coronavirus, and we are just being served so much more diversity than before. You could really say it was a watershed year, and we will be unpacking it for, you know, many more years. I think the implications of the year 2020 are not yet completed. And at the end, Stephen Paul Foster, you know, he gives me a shout out for having written a certain article during the certain events in Central Asia, that maybe, just maybe, there is going to be the beginning of a new normal 3.0 from the fall of Kabul and the resurgence of the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan. Although I don't think that the fall of Afghanistan itself is the major event, I think more than that, the reaction to it in the West and specifically among conservative Americans is the thing of note with regard to that event.
I actually got a question here from one of our readers, Sutton, who comments. He says, Nick, let me just read this verbatim. Nick has written about the Afghan situation. Greg, what are your thoughts on the Afghan withdrawal? And I would like to talk a bit about that because I think this is a tremendously important event. And yeah, I haven't commented on it really. I haven't written anything on it. But basically, several things come to mind. One, it's as we learn more about this, we realize that this is just what you'd expect with incompetence. These people were incompetent on so many levels. We've left how many billions of dollars in military equipment in the hands of the Taliban? Now, personally, I don't have that much against the Taliban. I don't want them here and I don't want to live in their country, but I don't want to be their enemy at the same time, but I certainly don't like the idea of American military equipment in their hands because, well, this part of the world being what it is, any one of these Taliban people is only 1 or 2 degrees of separation from somebody who's going to point one of those Stinger missiles at a civilian jetliner someday. It is catastrophically irresponsible to allow $85 billion worth of advanced military equipment to fall into the hands of these people. And apparently nobody in Washington had the common sense to do anything about that. We have people in the Pentagon who are paid to come up with contingency plans all their lives. They're paid to figure out how we would invade Denmark, right? They're paid to figure out how we would invade Finland. They come up with contingency plans over and over and over again. Nobody had a contingency plan for the rapid collapse of the Afghan regime and $85 billion of advanced military equipment falling into the hands of the Taliban. If they had such a plan, they would have blown up as much of this equipment as they possibly could to prevent it from falling into the hands of the Taliban, but they didn't. The way it was handled is just sheer stupidity. You don't even have to try and think of an ideological agenda or a special spin or whatever. It's just stupid. On any level, no serious country would conduct a withdrawal from another country like that, from an occupation, and not have contingency plans for preventing materiel like that from falling into the hands of our enemies. Beyond that, they also got all the biometric data for America's collaborators there. Amazing. This is how your biometric security state working for you. Apparently, they had all the biometric data for all these people, eye scans, I guess, and things like that. So it's going to be really easy for the Taliban to track down all of America's collaborators. Who knows? Maybe they even had all the biometric data for our CIA deep cover plants and things like that. I wouldn't put it past them with this level of stupidity. Another thing that really amazes me about the collapse of America's adventure in Afghanistan is the rapid news that China and Russia are on charm offensives and that the Chinese are already making plans to mine and exploit $1 trillion worth of known mineral reserves. Well, the first question that came to my mind is we spent about $2 trillion on this adventure, and it didn't occur to anybody that maybe we should mine $1 trillion worth of minerals while we were there for our own benefit to pay some of the bills. What was going on there? I do know that what we did do in our 20-year adventure in Afghanistan is we didn't take any important minerals out. We did certainly export a lot of opium, which of course only causes destruction and decay. And we were all about spreading liberal democracy, which of course is just more destruction and decay. And now that we're leaving, we're importing all kinds of more problems, namely Afghans, the next Omar Mateen, the next any number of rapists and terrorists have been transported into our countries. And beyond that, even the nicest Afghans don't belong in our countries. They're quite alien and inassimilable. And don't we all have enough problems to deal with the aftermath of COVID and Black Lives Matter and a stolen election, to go back to those themes? So the priorities that guided this entire operation on such a deep level are all things that promote decay. Decay in Afghanistan, decay in America. There's not a shred of calculation about how this adventure might make America stronger and more secure. Although, presumably, we were bamboozled into this whole thing with the promise of making Americans more secure. Well, apparently that happened relatively quickly. Osama bin Laden left the country very quickly. And at that point, there was no more rationale to be there except basically corporate greed, which, of course, goes hand in hand today with left-wing talking points, left-wing values. We can have any amount of corporate chicanery as long as they put a little green tree on the cup or a rainbow on the cup or whatever. That's the way it works. So we had trillions of dollars going into defense contractors' pockets in a vast two-decade grift, justified by spreading feminism and gay rights to Afghanistan, and it's all gone now. So just the sheer stupidity of it and the lack of seriousness of it is amazing. It kind of galls me that yes, America is ceding this territory basically to the Chinese. The Chinese are going to have a new sphere of influence here, and it's going to make China stronger. But frankly, we shouldn't have been there to begin with. And if we did have a foreign policy in that region that had anything to do with American interests, that would be one thing, but we lost sight of that a long time ago. And another thing is that they're blaming the wrong people. Joe Biden isn't the architect of 20 years of mismanagement, stupidity, grift, and imperial adventurism. And the idea that Biden should pay, that is just the instinct of all the worms in the deep state, in the military-industrial complex, the people who were the architects of this, the people who profited from this, pointing their fingers and trying to get rid of one of the front men, to get one of the front guys to take the fall. While the real operators, the really responsible people skate. The idea that Blinken is responsible for this, or any of the national security team that came in with the cabinet of Joe Biden is responsible for this, is absurd. They are ephemeral actors. They will be gone as a matter of course within this administration or when the administration ends. But it is the permanent deep state, the permanent bureaucracy, the military, which is just a bureaucracy, and the industrial complex, the defense contractors, they're the problem. And it would be great if we could actually leverage this into a movement to, pink slip a lot of the malefactors, but that's not happening. The Republicans, of course, don't want that to happen because they're in the pay of that very same military-industrial complex. So what are they doing? They're just trying to make cheap, ephemeral, partisan hay out of this by pointing the finger at Biden. And they are suddenly, they're suddenly neocons again. It's an absolute disaster, intellectually speaking, but that's what they're there for. Frankly, they're there to prevent a real nationalist populist right from ever forming. And boy, they're showing their paid false opposition bona fides. It's really, really clear. They're showing a whole lot of that. Anyway, that's my rant about Afghanistan.
And what a rant it really is. I mean, this should be written down and put somewhere where people can access it, you know, for future reference. And I agree with everything. And I agree with everything you said. I will, however, retort, just playing devil's advocate here, that some people, you know, people in the chat have been commenting on the subject. And of course, Semiagog, the commentator, has been very vocal about this, that it may not necessarily be incompetence that left all this equipment to the Taliban, but perhaps this equipment has been put there with the hopes that the Taliban would maybe cause trouble for the global homo's geopolitical rivals in China and Russia and possibly even Iran. Because, I mean, as we know, the Taliban are Sunni and Iran is Shia. So, you know, let's keep that in mind. Maybe it's not all incompetence. And Mr. Foster seems to think that it's not all incompetence. He seems to he believes that the response to the coronavirus, the he calls it open and shut, hot and cold clutching, which will, you know, tweaking and relaxing the various the degree of freedom curtailment in the West due to the coronavirus. And he believes that this is, I guess, some ploy to get us inured to, well, basically becoming, all of us becoming wards of the state, being locked in our houses with digital identification, you know, the vaccine passport, which has been so touted, and ultimately universal basic income replacing the economy, people working. Do you have any opinion of that? I mean, I have my own opinions, but I want to hear yours first.
Well, I do think that many of the Americans left behind and the way that that was handled could have been precisely the deep state manufacturing an excuse to go back in there. We can't leave any man behind. We've got to save these Americans. Right. That could be precisely the ploy. They want an excuse to go back in. It's conceivable. We're dealing. Look, war is mass murder. When you're dealing with mass murderers, you're dealing with people who are capable of any level of deceit and treachery. Okay. So these people are in the business of mass murder. And they're in the business of lies, so they are capable of any level of deceit and treachery. That said, I'm still thinking it's probably just stupidity, and they might not have been thinking even that far ahead. But that is a possibility. I don't think that the Taliban are going to make any trouble at all for Iran. The Taliban used to be Sunni extremists, but now they work with Shiites within Afghanistan. They, you know, 20 years have gone by. They have evolved a lot. Most of the people who are carrying guns for the Taliban were children 20 years ago when the United States arrived. It has evolved as an institution. It has cordial relations with the Chinese. It's got cordial relations with the Russians. It's got cordial relations with Pakistan, and India is even paying court to them. Basically, once the United States left, a lot of these countries thought this is great. We have how many fewer massive American air bases in Central Asia now? There are lots of geopolitical possibilities in terms of trade and things like that are opened up by this. So I honestly think the Taliban are going to have a long honeymoon of very cordial relations with their neighbors. And I'm sure that in the bowels of the Pentagon and the equivalent in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, they are trying to come up with ways to shorten that honeymoon and create as much conflict as they can in the area. But I can't emphasize what a setback this is for instance, the people who want to invade and destroy Iran. You know who they are. The people who have been gunning to destroy Iran have lost a country on the border of Iran with massive American military bases that were basically one of the most important strategic assets for eventually waging a war in Iran. That's gone.
As people have pointed out in the past, and here again I will credit Semyolov, Iran was de facto besieged by America and her clients, you know, Turkey and Iraq, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and maybe even Turkmenistan. And now, with the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban and to the and the mutual assistance deal between the Taliban and China, now Iran has an overland route to China, mm-hmm. and it can now finally reach into the world's markets through China, whereas previously it was hemmed in, you know, constrained by. And the U.S. was actually able to impose an embargo. Now that embargo may be violated through Afghanistan.
Right, yeah. So there are a lot of negatives for this. I don't see any upsides for the United States for this in terms of calculated Machiavellian geopolitical stuff that people like to truck in. I just think this is a catastrophic failure of the United States, and I think the world sees that. And they're kind of puzzled by how quickly it happened, how badly it happened, how terrible it looks for the United States. I'm kind of amazed at that myself. And my thoughts about this, my final thought about this really, is that it may be later than we think for the American empire. It may be so decrepit that it doesn't have even 10 more years of life left in it, maybe not even five. This is how institutions are destroyed. You know, institutions have goals, like the fire department's there to put out fires. Well, great, but the fire department has, you know, shiny trucks and good public relations and well-paying jobs. And if there aren't a lot of fires going on, what do people do? They eye the fire department. They think, you know, we need more women in the fire department and more Black people and more Chinamen. We need them to do lots of other things for the community besides fighting fires. And so what they do is they hollow the thing out. It still looks like the fire department. It's still got the big shiny truck and the Dalmatian, although maybe they've got other dogs there for diversity too, and cats and a goldfish or something. But, you know, it doesn't actually have people in it who are chosen to perform its specific function and who care about performing its specific function. And what that can go on for a very, very long time until there's a serious fire, right? And then when it's tested with having to deal with a serious fire, you realize, oh my God, the fire department has been replaced by the Keystone Cops, basically. It's a farce now. It's an empty, failing farce. But you only know that when it's tested. And what do we have with the United States military? Well, the United States military was looked upon as a vast jobs program, as a vast experimental laboratory for social engineering, because they have to say, sir, yes, sir, and then do something stupid whenever somebody in a pantsuit tells them to, right? So they've been hollowing it out for decades now. And they've been promoting careerists who are behind the SJW type agenda. They've been promoting people for diversity, racial, sexual, and God knows otherwise, rather than competence for decades now. This has been going on for decades. And it all looks great when all they have to do is press buttons and blow up wedding parties from halfway across the globe. But when their social engineering scheme actually collapses like a house of cards overnight, then you realize, oh my God, it's hollowed out, it's weakened, it's not capable of performing its function. And we now know that because it's finally been tested, right? And you wonder how many other departments of the federal government have been tested, you know, have not yet been tested in the same way, but they've been hollowed out and they will fail when they are tested. I remember shortly after Biden came in, Tucker Carlson had this amazing segment where he had some stuff from some video conference from some part of the federal bureaucracy where these women would come on and they would say, my name is so-and-so, such-and-such, and I acknowledge that I'm on the ancestral stolen lands of the Mukwap Indians, and I acknowledge their plant-based and Stone Age wisdom. And it was, and you know, it was one after another. And I just thought, the American government has been taken over by a religious cult. You know, they have these stupid beliefs, these stupid litanies, these stupid rituals, and all of these ambitious people, these well-meaning, ambitious people who just want to fit in or who want to, you know, climb the greasy pole are rushing forward to profess that they believe in the new cult, but it's exactly the kind of behavior you get in a religious cult. That kind of cult-like thinking is what's hollowing out all the authoritative institutions of our society. And I want to see them stress tested. And 2020 was a great stress test for a lot of our institutions, and they failed miserably. We failed to deal with COVID. We failed to deal with Black Lives Matter rioting in, 300 cities. We failed to deal with a stolen election. We're just going to be paying prices for those failures. The bills for those failures are continuing to mount to this very day.
Yeah, and I got to add that as a foreigner's perspective, right? One of the silliest things I have to endure as someone who's a little with it here in Macedonia and elsewhere in Europe is people are still looking up to America as a great democratic society. They'll say things like, oh, well, you know, countries in the Balkans are corrupt and undemocratic, and we have local strongmen ruling, and we have graft and corruption. And our fire departments in Macedonia were tested this summer with massive forest fires, and I'm sad to say they barely passed the test. It was a D-. The fires were contained through massive volunteer effort and with help from Austria and Italy, and then, you know, until Italy had to deal with its own fires, at least. People look at America, right, and they look at the rioting of BLM, and they see the I want to call it the incompetence of the United States military, but whatever it is, and they seriously start doubting America's status as the quote-unquote shining city of on a hill from Ronald Reagan's speeches, and of course American self-perception. When we see the blatant election theft of the type we saw in November of 2020, when you see the anarchy, or more specifically, the anarcho-tyranny of the BLM and Antifa riots, people stop looking to America with awe and reverence, right? They stop thinking of, well, maybe our countries are shit, but America's good. Well, no, it's not like that. America's even more corrupt than our countries. At least we're open about our, or at least more open about our corruption. Yeah, you take a bottle of whiskey to the court clerk to move things along, but that does not compare to the kind of corruption we see from the State Department under Hillary Clinton or the presidency under Joe Biden. It's just orders of magnitude worse. And so I want to thank, and of course, Mr. Stephen Paul Foster gives me personally a shout out for my own article on the fall of Kabul. So I want to thank him for that. And I want to segue into our next selection of the best of countercurrents for this week, which is Thomas Steuben's The Military's Culture of Careerism, which I found just amazing. This is an insider's view of America's military. And as someone who's not a military man, but who has seen his fair share of bureaucratic, what comes out of a bull's rear's end, you don't really think of the army as having these problems, or at least not the American army. I mean, they're supposed to be fierce warriors and whatnot. They defeated Saddam Hussein's army within a week, or how long it took them in 2003. But this picture, which Mr. Steuben paints for us, is quite frankly appalling, not just in the sense that diversity is eating away at the United States military like a cancer, but even absent the diversity, the bourgeois culture of careerism, the chase for promotion, the chase for advancement is hollowing out what used to be this great fighting machine. So, Greg, what is your thoughts on this? I mean, the two of us are civilians. I would much appreciate it if people with military experience would read the article and comment on it. But I was just reminded of dealing with in my 6 years and as an attorney with the Macedonian Revenue Service, right, with the Directorate of Public Acquisitions, which is just as serpentine and Byzantine as you imagine it. But that's what the United States military is described as in this article.
One thing that struck me as especially stupid about the system in the United States military today is they have this idea of up or out. You have to move up the ranks or get out. Now, that is just absolute folly. Now, it's pure bourgeois careerism. The mentality there is that upward mobility is the hallmark of every good bourgeois striver. And if you don't move up the ranks, you're out. Well, what does that mean? It means that people who are excellent in the lower ranking positions will be discharged if they don't strive to be promoted into a job where they're incompetent. I can't think of a more perfect way to sabotage an institution than to institutionalize moving up the ranks to the point where you're incompetent, basically. Moving people who are happy as a private, as a, you know, doing some kind of, maybe it's a technical thing, maybe it's dirty work, but maybe they enjoy it. They whistle while they work and they enjoy it. There are all kinds of people in the military, all levels of ability. And if you find a person who's absolutely fantastic in certain low-ranking positions, why not just let them make a career out of that? Isn't that the best way to make sure that important jobs, even the most humble, actually find people who do them competently and get them done, as opposed to to pressuring these people and saying, look, if you don't try and get promotion, you're just going to be discharged. I can't think of a more diabolically simple and stupid rule. If you're trying to make the military fail, just follow that rule for 30 years, and it'll fail without any of the other diversity stuff.
Okay, yeah, I agree with that. And there is a name for that phenomenon, which you just described, in economics and in personnel, whatever they call personnel science. It's called the Peter Principle. It's you get promoted until you're above your pay grade. Where the idea of promotions as reward for good work results in, not just in the military, but across sectors, people getting promoted until they're way in over their head. And people tend to forget that the skill set of a manager, or in the military context, someone who ought to command men, and especially this is important, I would say, in the enlisted ranks, in the non-commissioned officers, is very different from the skill set necessary to perform tasks. And I know from my own career, like as an attorney, one of my colleagues was criticized for being, quote unquote, unambitious. He wouldn't take, charge of cases. He tried not to litigate. And this was because he was just not a poor, but below average litigator. Where he really shined through was as an administrator. And believe it or not, offices need administrators. They need people who think of, hey, do we have enough paper clips? Do we not have enough, toner for the printer? Do the people who do the actual litigating and the actual lawyer work and meet with clients and everything, do they have everything they need to perform their tasks? And but by demanding that this person is ambitious, what you're going to do is you're going to cost the organization a very competent administrator. And of course, they're going to be unhappy once they're promoted over their head and fail at what is expected at them. And the answer to that is just let people be in the place where they are the best. But that unfortunately requires judgment. It's another thing I was commenting with a friend the other day. The modern bureaucratic model, not just of government, not just of military, but of basically industrial economy of any kind, anytime human beings need to work or do anything, does not like the non-measurable and therefore does not like to use judgment. What's necessary in these things? How do you know if someone's not fit maybe to be promoted to, corporal or ensign, but not sergeant? How do you know that? Well, the answer is judgment. The answer is an officer knows his men, and if he knows his men well, he will develop the necessary judgment to tell whether this guy, he's just a really good soldier, or does he have the makings of command? And the same thing functions in commercial and industrial contexts as well, in academic contexts as well. Sometimes a good lecturer does not make a good professor or a department chair, because they maybe are really just the nerdy guy who knows a lot about a specific subject, but they're not cut out for leadership. The department chair has to have leadership skills. I remember a lot of people during my academic period where basically they were promoted to department chair or dean of faculty even due to seniority, but they had no managerial skills whatsoever. So that's the Peter principle is real, and it is the bane of many organizations. And I want to thank Mr. Steuben for his wonderful elucidating article he wrote. The failures of the United States military are evident, but we have to look at their roots. We have to look at where these things come from. It's not just the diversity. It's not just the anti-whiteism. If it were only those things, then we wouldn't really have to think about the military problem in the ethnostate. But even in 100% white homogenous military, you would have the problem of careerism. And indeed, we see it in the militaries of the European countries, which are, for their part, 100% white. I had a conversation recently with someone who was a retired member of the French military. And he says that despite the growing diversity of France, the French army is 100% white, and interestingly enough, 60-something percent Breton. So there's basically barely even French people there. It's just Bretons from the Celtic-speaking region of France, where Asterix and Obelix famously come from. And but the French military, the English, the British military, the German military faces all of these problems, all of these bureaucratic problems. And I blame this bureaucratic culture of management, which drips out from NATO outwards into the European militaries. It probably begins with Robert McNamara or something silly like that, someone who thinks they can use industrial principles to run an army. Do you have any Do you have any speculations where this might come from?
I do think it's just the mindset of capitalism, basically, and capitalist management seeping into the military. In a good world, in a just, well-run society, careerism wouldn't be a bad thing. The only reason why it's a dirty word is because institutions have been set up such that the wrong people make a career out of it, right? If we had a well-organized military, the best people would make a career out of it, and the people who aren't that good would be rotated out. Instead, what we have adopted is the attitude that ambition to go up the ranks is a marker of quality, but that's not necessarily true. I think a society where people are content in whatever place they are at, if they're doing a good job and if they feel suited for it, is actually a better society than a society where people feel alienated because they have a humble job, right? You want people who have humble jobs to be proud of their work and to feel like they are in no way inferior to people who are, you know, better paid because they have more demanding professions and things like that. The fact is that the lawyer who's well paid would be miserable in a lot of humbler jobs that are absolutely necessary for society to function. So I think that we need to honor people for doing a good job at whatever level of society they're at. And it doesn't necessarily mean this striver culture where people are always trying to get more money, or this idea of social mobility, that your children are a failure if you are a construction worker and your children are not doctors and lawyers, you've somehow failed them. Well, your kids, if they're cut out to be doctors and lawyers, fine. But the idea that everybody has to, you know, each generation has to move up some kind of career hierarchy is, I think it's a foolish thing. And it dishonors the people who don't move up. And it encourages people who probably end up pushing themselves into positions where they're incompetent. And so the whole society fails because of that.
It is an amazing thing. People in the chat are saying that this is merchants running the military. Yeah, and this is why I mentioned Robert McNamara. He was famously some sort of efficiency expert at Ford. I believe he was employed by the Ford Motor Company as a manager before becoming Secretary of Defense under John F. Kennedy, and then tried running the military as he did the Ford Motor Company, which is an army is not a car manufacturer, as simple as that. And a lot of people make this mistake that basically we can take the principle of industrial or commercial management and apply them to the business estate. And while there is overlap between the skills of a good CEO and the skills of a good president or king, they're not the same thing. And people who are good at running companies aren't necessarily good at running states. I think we saw that with Mr. Trump in the 4 years he spent as president. And I lost my train of thought. I was going to say something smart, I guess.
Well, there's a point here that occurs to me. Let me say it before I forget it. The way that wages are determined for a given job, you know, according to economic theory, is that the wage is set for a given job based on the last guy hired who's basically the least productive person. It's been years since I've taken economics, so I'm forgetting the term. But the point is that if you are working on an assembly line, the company is making a profit from the least productive guy on that assembly line. Okay. They've set the wage structure, so they're going to be okay and in the black with the least productive guy in the assembly line. What that means is that if you are the most productive and efficient guy in your wage class, you're basically giving the company a huge unpaid bonus, okay? Because you're not making anything more, you're not making any more at, per hour than the least productive guy. And so the people who do a really good job are actually not rewarded. And that's just the way that the system is constructed. The only way that you're rewarded for doing a really, really good job is if they notice you and promote you. And then the thing is there that they will promote you maybe two or three times until you find that you are the least productive guy in that new category that you've now arrived at. That is a completely irrational system. And it's a form of exploitation that I think is wickeder than anything that Karl Marx dreamed up with his stupid labor theory of value. But that is how the system works. People who are really good at a job are basically not paid any better than people who are completely mediocre or people right on the brink of being fired. Okay. And everything that you do over and above the least productive guy in your wage class is a gift that you're making to your employer. And again, the only way they can reward you for that is to promote you. But if they do that long enough, you will end up being that drone. And so that is an irrational form of economic organization. And it's an irrational thing when it comes to the military as well.
Yeah, but a compounding factor here is that if people get promoted to managerial positions, which they shouldn't hold, right, they're not suited to, and many people who are phenomenal workers make for very poor managers. And this actually we know from a Prussian military manual, which says that if someone is lazy and stupid, they should be a soldier, because lazy and stupid people are motivated by pay and beatings. So they're fairly easy to manage. If someone is hardworking and smart, they should be on the general staff. They should be the general's aide-de-camp, because generals need people who are smart and hardworking and around them. If someone is lazy and smart, then they should be considered for command, because apparently lazy people have better emotional control and sang-froid. This, I don't know how the Prussian military concluded. It is just stated in the Prussian field manual. And if someone is stupid and hardworking, they should be kept away from any form of military position, because they'll just find some stupid thing and execute it very efficiently with frightening efficiency.
Yeah,
so that is basically that is what we're having with here in the situation of the best worker is someone who is very hardworking and very smart being promoted to a command position, which they're not suited for. Command is for the intelligent but lazy, for whatever reason. I mean, I'm not, I don't understand why. But my experience in both, you know, as a worker and in the managerial posts I've held has shown this to be true, that people who are hard workers are very bad at directing work. I guess it's the temptation to do everything themselves because they don't really mind work, whereas someone who's lazy, he's just going to delegate. And ironically, delegating things is how you manage, you know. Because someone is lazy, they observe the other workers, you know who is best at what, so you know where to put these various cogs of the machine.
That's a really interesting point. There's something, this is sort of, well, this is appropriate, but it may seem a little off. When you read Aristotle's Ethics, and he talks about the great-souled man, the magnanimous man, he's really talking about a sort of perfect person, a person who's got all the virtues, basically. to a great degree. So this is a figure who's fit to be a commander or a president or a general or something like that. And one of the things that he says about great-souled men is that they don't move quickly or speak quickly. And I thought that was very interesting. Why is that? Well, I just see old Joe Biden sprinting up the stairs and falling. You know, there's something, George Bush the First with his squeaky voice. Men who speak quickly and rush around with sheafs of paper in their hands and sprint up and down stairs. Those are energetic people, yeah, and you would want them if you're going to have people running errands for you. But you expect the people in command to be sort of a still point in the center of all this activity, right? You want a person who's in command to be deliberate, to be calm and deliberate, and unhurried, unruffled, his attention undivided. And so I can see where the Prussians would say, you'd rather have somebody who's inclined to be lazy than inclined to be busy and bustling in a position like that. Because they're the kind of person who can be calm at the center of a storm, deliberate, gather his forces, make a decision, etc., better than somebody who's just some agitated little functionary. And that's one of the horrible things about American presidents. Our American presidents, with the exception of Trump, the persona of most American presidents, I think from Bill Clinton on, has been, sort of agitated, goofy functionaries. That's not the mark of a serious leader.
Yeah, I would add to that one world leader who is known for his calm, for his unagitated, slow and deliberate movement is Vladimir Putin. Yeah. Whatever else you may say of the man, he is that kind of, and I'm probably going to lose street cred for saying this, Stephen Harper, the former Prime Minister of Canada, who for all his faults actually managed the 2008 crisis well, and Canada, well, it fared better than other Western nations. But Vladimir Putin is a slow and deliberate man in his movement. You can see it when he's giving interviews. He has a slow pace of speaking. Another thing I'll add is, for all the people who are thinking China is based, China is cool, Xi Jinping is a nervous, neurotic little man. His speech is just too fast, and the Chinese as a people speak too fast, they move too fast. But when we're going to discuss these things on a future writer's block, there are things always happening in the pipeline, in the background. So I think we have exhausted the subject of basically careerism and merchant virtue penetrating into the military.
Yeah, we've got some questions and comments here.
We have questions.
Yeah, so let's thank some people. Ganser Prenadier, 2 Ice Cream, thank you very much. Alaska Chaga, 1 Diamond, and another Diamond. Old Man Yinzer, 2 Lemons. Slog, 14 Lemons. Deconstruct, 1 Diamond, 2 Diamonds, 3 Diamonds, 4 Diamonds, 5 Diamonds. Thank you very much. Norse Nature, 3 Ice Cream. Varyag, 1 Diamond. Careerism equals consequence of biological constructivism. One thing about Putin, he is shorter than Xi. Xi is actually a very tall Chinaman. He's kind of physically imposing. That is true. Ganser Prenadier, 1 Diamond. How's the new Savitri Devi archive coming along? Our guy, and you might have met our guy who's doing the work on it, is moving rapidly to a conclusion. I was hoping it would come out in August. It's going to definitely be rolled out in September. And I'm also going to announce the next two Savitri Devi translation volumes. I have two brand spanking new translations that need to go to press. I'm just waiting until I get Yaki, the enemy of Europe, through the press. And those are Memories and Reflections of an Aryan Woman, which has been translated now in toto from French, and her unpublished book from the early 60s, Hart wie Kruppstahl, Hard as Steel, which she wrote in German. That's been translated as well. So I am expecting Memories and Reflections. I'm going to try and get it out by the end of this year, and Hart wie Kruppstahl, Hard as Steel by March.
Not just any steel. It's Krupp Age steel, right?
Yeah, that's yeah.
Best steel in the world.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, anyway, we're just going to translate it steel into English because it doesn't, Kruppstahl doesn't have the resonance in English. And Slog has donated one more diamond.
Yeah, one of those strange instances where a brand basically consumes the whole class of products, becomes synonymous with them. Yeah, I believe yeah. Kleenex has done that for tissues Xerox, in America.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
we use Paloma here in the Balkans because, you know, the most popular, and we call tissues Paloma because that's the most popular brand.
That's interesting. Isn't that like Spanish for dove or something like that?
Yeah, it is.
Blowing
it
your nose on a dove.
I don't think the owner knew it at the time he founded the company.
Well, when I was in Hungary, one of the funniest things I saw was a brand of toilet tissue called Oops. I took a picture of it, and do you remember at the beginning of Pulp Fiction where Jules and Vincent are talking, and Vincent says, "You know the thing about Europe, it's the little differences." And I posted a picture of Oops tissue and that line on my Facebook, but that's been gone. That's been memory hold because Zuckerberg says I can't have any friends. Anyway, so C has
this is donated. The writer's block, right? And it's new and rebranded in classier. We're talking about Oops toilet paper.
Yes, exactly. Brought to you by Oops. Okay, so C has sent $3. Thank you. Gadius last week sent us $25. I appreciate that very much. And then today we have gotten a number of donations. C has also sent another $10. Thank you. Scott has written in with $10. Do you find there is a tendency within the right to describe the state of the world as the outcome of impersonal forces like history, that it was preordained in some way, the Kali Yuga, rather than being freely chosen by human beings? I think that's a very interesting question. I think people on the right really do both. I think that there are two levels of analysis here. That when you talk about individuals in their daily lives, you see them making choices. And, you know, somebody's got to be held responsible for the consequences of people's choices. So why not the person making the choice? If you make sure that people pay the price or enjoy the rewards of good choices, you have more good choices and fewer bad choices. So it's a good way of running a society, and we can leave out metaphysical questions of free will entirely. But you do notice that even though everyone's making choices and they think they're maximizing their utility based on the options available, et cetera, if you stand back, you see these large macro patterns. And those patterns move as if they are determined by impersonal forces. And you can talk about forces like the laws of history. Does history progress? Does history move in cycles? Does history move in corkscrews and things like that? I think that people on the right can do justice to both of those perspectives because both are true. It's just they're true on different levels of analysis. But those are my thoughts about it. Nick, what are your thoughts about the tendency of people on the right to talk about big deterministic historical forces?
Well, it's present there. It's very present on the right, and it's present for the reasons you mentioned. And the second, I mean, there's two more reasons I see. The first is that the right tends to be more religious than the left. And so we ascribe, I mean, we tend to interpret the world through a religious lens. And this is not necessarily a bad thing. And of course, if you interpret the world through a religious lens, you have what I like to call a theory of history. You have a theory as to how history will conduct itself, you know, in the past, and how it has gone in the past, and how it will go in the future. And I think the second reason is precisely because of the tension between the open-ended future and the predetermined future, because both are sort of truth. You know, as we've said, this paradoxical tension attracts the aristocratic soul, because the aristocratic soul inhabits the space between these two edges of a paradox. Like I like to speak of the aristocrat as someone who is ultra individualistic and ultra collectivistic at the same time. And this is very difficult for people to get their heads around. But what you see in the best of humanity is they have a presence of personality which normal people just don't have, that they have an unquestionable and indomitable will that other people don't have. But at the same time, they do not exercise this will for their own sake, but actually take on the burdens of the world, of their own tribe, of their own people, onto themselves. This is someone who could live a charmed and blessed life. I mean, a charmed life, an easy life, could just basically born with a gift from God, but they choose to live a difficult life for their people, to put their massive talents in the service of their people. And I think that this tension between history as made as by man and history as made by immutable laws of history is what attracts the dissident right in particular. I think the tension, the paradox in of itself. And personally, I believe in both positions, that there are laws of history, but that there are also great men who drive history, not by violating its laws. I mean, an airplane does not violate gravity, but it is still a thing which exists in physics. I think my metaphor doesn't quite function. So we should probably move on. Are there any more questions?
Yeah, Jasper has written in with $50. Thank you very much. I discovered Countercurrents around May 2019. I learned a lot from the numerous articles on the website, and I found the podcast to be highly educational. Since then, I've had a chance to read Greg's White Nationalist Manifesto and Toward a New Nationalism. These are great resources to newcomers. I cannot recommend them enough to anyone who is new to the movement. Read, read, read. Well, thank you very much. I have to mention something. I just learned this yesterday. The new edition of the White Nationalist Manifesto in French has apparently been doing fairly well. And various French militants and leaders and talking heads have been reading it and talking about it. I wrote back to this friend of mine who wrote to me and said, oh, please send me some links to that. I'm just made a liar of myself. I'm looking at my email right now, and I haven't actually hit send on that yet. Anyway, I'll hit send on it, and then I won't be telling a fib. And the same person who wrote to me has just finished translating Toward a New Nationalism into French. And that is very gratifying. We decided on a slightly different version of Toward a New Nationalism, because there's a lot of stuff in the English language edition that's sort of American-centric. And so we cut a bunch of it, a bunch of stuff. And I think it's actually a more cohesive and better book because of it. And so we also added a couple of essays to it. One is the It's Okay to Be White essay, which he translated. And the other is the Irreconcilable Differences essay, The Case for Racial Divorce, although that wasn't in the proposed table of contents he sent. But anyway, that'll probably be in there too. So that will probably come out in French next year, which makes me very pleased. And I'm trying to already get the same guy to work on White Identity Politics. It's like, oh, thank you for translating one of my books. Here's another. So
this is why I don't try too hard, because if you do really good, what the result is usually more work. You know, as Mrs. Gilvey would put it, you know, she's been quote unquote promoted. She's been given more power in her professional contest. And what does that mean? Well, it means more responsibility with the same pay. So more power.
Yeah. Well, here's another question. This is an actual question from Jasper, $50 as well. I was going to ask Greg and Nick what they think about Liebach and their album Folk in particular, but after doing search on the Countercurrents website, I found Greg already has written a piece about that album back in 2010. Is there anything new either of you have to add about the group since then? So do you have any thoughts on Liebach, Nick?
We're gonna fight over this, but I think they're overrated. Maybe it's a generational thing, but I just don't feel Liebach, I guess. I like the one they have, Tanz mit Liebach, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, which is okay. Yeah. I like the militaristic beat of that. I like the whole aesthetic, but to me, I am a younger guy. I'm a millennial, so I don't know. I think they're slightly overrated, not criminally overrated, not Bono levels overrated, but yeah, they are overrated a little bit.
Well, I've been a Liebach fan for 20 years solidly now, even longer. Yeah,
it's a personal loyalty thing for you as well, due to Charles Kraft's friendship with Liebach.
Well, you know, I even liked Liebach before I met Charlie. So, but yeah, I mean, the fact that he knew the band was very cool. I actually went with Charlie to a Liebach concert in Seattle when they did their Spectre tour. Anyway, I'm a big fan of Liebach. I really like the Folk album. The one they brought out a few years later called Spectre, I think is absolutely fantastic. It's one of their best. I've seen them play live 3 times. I've seen them play in Seattle, in Budapest, and in Ljubljana, which is their hometown. Well, close to their hometown. They're from Slovenia. And they are on tour again. I wish I could get out and see them again, because I really like their stuff. So you asked about developments since Folk. Well, Spectre is a major development since the Folk album, and I think it's one of the best things that they've ever done. They added a woman to the band, a female singer named Mina Spieler. And boy, their sales went up because she's a pretty girl and she's got a great voice. And that album is her main showcase album. It's quite good. It's so interesting because the music is catchy and listenable and danceable, but you listen to it carefully and you think, is this even music in places? because it's highly electronic, industrial kind of music, but it's not noise. It's very melodic and easy on the ears, but a lot of it's just sort of a collage of sounds. And yet it's pleasing. So anyway, I think they're a great group, and objectively they're nationalist. They started out, they've been around for 40 years now, I believe 40 years. They started out in Tito's Yugoslavia, or, you know, communist Yugoslavia. And then they transitioned into being one of the bigger things in the little country of, Slovenia. Zizek is maybe bigger than Liebach now in terms of international recognition, but still they were the biggest thing in Slovenia for a long time. So yeah, I highly recommend Spectre. Check it out. There's actually a review at Countercurrents by a terrible human being, but he actually wrote a pretty darn good review of Spectre.
We have terrible human beings writing for us.
It's like the military, although it's well run at Countercurrents because we bring in a lot of recruits and we promote the good ones and we get rid of the terrible ones or the terrible human beings. So anyway, yeah, there is a great review of Spectre on there.
Just hit me that at this point, probably the world's most famous Slovenians are Slavoj Žižek and Melania Trump. It's amazing, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. She's a credit to the Slovenian race, definitely.
Although she is of German descent, I believe, partially. Žižek is a little suspect. I've heard rumors that Žižek might be a crypto Serb, but who knows?
The crypto Serbs, yeah. They're the worst. Redline writes in with $25. Do you think it is a sign of the growing influence of the dissident right on American politics that the seemingly psyop of trying to get the West back into Afghanistan completely failed? Well, I do think that it's going to be a flop trying to get the West back into Afghanistan. It's just going to be there's no political will to do that. And a lot of us are just saying, we've heard this shit before, this neocon stuff. These people have been totally discredited by any rational thinking person. And enough people are saying that, that I think it's falling flat. And already now Trump, who's a real opportunist on this kind of stuff, unfortunately, Trump is shearing away and saying, no, we don't need all these refugees here. For a few minutes, it was, oh, we have to get our people out. You know, this is a shameful abandonment, blah, blah, blah. Some good sense and some populism is now asserting itself within the Republican ranks. I give Tucker Carlson a lot of credit for this. There are other forces. The position that Republicans should take on this is that we don't want a single Afghan. We have enough problems with America as it is. We do not want to import the next Omar Mateen into the United States. Remember him? We don't want to import, you know, there's all this talk about fighting wars to save homosexuals and feminists from the evil Taliban. And then we import Omar Mateens and hordes of rapists from these countries into our own countries. That belies these claims of concern, right? If people are concerned about women's rights, then we don't import rapey people from the Middle East, okay? That's the bottom line. If you're concerned about gay rights, you don't import the next Omar Mateen who went and shot, 50-odd people at a gay nightclub in Florida.
It could be even worse. America could import the next Ilhan Omar, who also came as a refugee, right? It's not merely terrorism. It's not merely, you know, bullets and bombs type terrorism, but now it's terrorism at the level of we will infiltrate your political system and turn your country into a shithole.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is even more dangerous. I would say that Omar Mateen killed 50 people. Ilhan Omar, through her actions, could kill many more and probably already has.
Absolutely, yeah. Archie writes in with $5. Here's the deal. I notice that natural leaders take charge when the situation arises, but we must be wary of egotistical whack jobs like Biden that just want the title, prestige, and status. Absolutely. I mean, this is a problem with leadership. And this is why I was somewhat hesitant when Mike last week was talking about, you see a guy, you know, who looks like a leader, you get behind him. It's like the people who want to push themselves forward as leaders, especially in marginal political movements, you know, I don't trust that. I don't trust the motivation of somebody like that. The best leader is a person who has to be basically dragged kicking and screaming into the leadership role. He's got to play hard to get before I'm even going to consider them. for him for the job. The kind of people who say, I want to be a leader. It's like, are you sure? Are you serious? It's not always fun. And it's an act of selflessness, okay, to really take on the role of running a political movement. It's a selfless act. And when you see somebody rushing forward who gives off a highly selfish, egotistical vibe, you run. You run from those people. Don't walk, run. Nick, what are your thoughts about leaders?
Well, I've been in a leadership position in my life, and I will say this, it's probably the hardest work I've ever done. And another thing I will add to what you've already said, I will agree. Look for people who would do it even if there were no ermine cape and associated baubles. Look for people who do not really care about the status or material gain, but actually really just want to direct the flow of matters so that it is optimal. And as we grow as a movement, now already we are at the point where as a movement, the movement can, through donations, support a cottage industry of intellectuals and content creators and thought leaders. I expect we will be seeing more people trying to enter this thing and trying to, quote unquote, grift, so attain material gain or attain status gain, you know, look for followers, look for female followers, which is always a factor with these things. And we should be wary. You should know, you should try to cultivate your judgment to see if someone will do it, even if there is no ermine cape, even if there is no super chats. And that's my advice to people. Exercise judgment. Our enemy is very weak because they're afraid of judgment. They want to bureaucratize everything. We have to bring back the art of practicing judgment. And this is why, for example, I'm a fan of Edward Dutton, even though he reduces things to, he's a little bit reductionist. But he has really resurrected the art of judging someone by what they look like. And personally, I'm a big believer in physiognomy. I think physiognomy doesn't lie. People were commenting that Putin is short. Well, guess what? Shorter men tend to be higher in testosterone, apparently. You know, take it up with Dutton. I'm of comfortably average height, so I'm,
You don't have a dog in that particular fight.
Have a dog of that. I like it when in his book where he describes, the facial features of high testosterone men. Yeah, I can see myself in that description. So I'm a supporter of Dutton, I guess, in that respect.
There is a wonderful biography that I read a review of. I haven't read it yet. Let me be perfectly honest. It's in that category of books I haven't yet read. It's by Tom Gallagher. It's called Salazar, the Dictator Who Refused to Die. It's a new biography of Antonio Salazar, who was the dictator in Portugal in the 20th century for 40 years. And he was a great man and a fascinating figure. And if you have certain stereotypes about Latin dictators, I'm afraid Salazar is going to disappoint all of your stereotypes. He was absolutely incorruptible and entirely devoted to the public good. Near the end of his life, he had a domestic accident. I think it was a deck chair collapsed or something, and then he had like a stroke or something like that. And that's how he basically fell from power. He was just, his life ended basically at a certain point. And it was discovered that he didn't have any money to pay for his health care. So the parliament had to vote a special fund to pay for his health care. And I thought that was rather extraordinary. He was just this utterly self-effacing servant of the people who ruled his country for 40 years, kept things going on a pretty good basis. he wanted to hold on to the African colonies and things like that. That was probably a mistake. But he was an important political figure who steered his country through a very difficult period of history. And yet he was an utterly selfless and self-effacing figure. That's an interesting type. I want to read more about him. I just want to get to know more about the guy. But that's on my reading list. Let's put it that way.
That's someone who we should put a pin in it. And this is what a good leader from history looks like.
Yeah. Another leader from the 20th century that I'm reading about now, although the biography I got is not that good, I'm afraid, is Miklos Horthy, who is the leader of Hungary in the interwar period. There are very few decisions this man made that I can criticize, and yet he led his country through basically 25 years of extreme difficulty. He saved his nation from communism like Franco did. I admire him tremendously. And he was a military man and basically a dictator. But he, was not some kind of megalomaniac, power mad, blood-soaked megalomaniac. He was a servant of the people, again, and a very impressive guy. So, yeah, that's an interesting type. And we will see those types emerge when we need them.
Yeah. Mr. Steuben, in his article on the United States military, speculates that it is so heavily bureaucratized to prevent the rise of men like Douglas MacArthur and George S. Patton, because these men are a threat. These types of men are a threat to the liberal regime. Especially, some like George S. Patton, who was woke on, a certain question of a certain tribe, and was convinced at the end, after the Second World War, that we, quote, fought the wrong enemy. He came to believe, after spending time in Germany, that the real enemy of the West was the Soviet Union, rather than the Nazi state, the National Socialist German state. So the rise of this men had to be prevented in the future. And this is, Mr. Steuben speculates that this is the impetus for bureaucratizing the military so that the absolute highest ranks of officers, where the generals, where all the decisions are made, are complete slaves to global homo. That's the first thing. The second thing is these people are always rotated, so no personal loyalty can develop to the commander. So Caesarism, or as it was known in the Soviet Union, Bonapartism, could be avoided. A history of the Soviet and Russian military tells us that the man Stalin most feared was Georgi Zhukov, because Georgi Zhukov, who was Marshal of the Soviet Union in the Second World War, was so admired by the Soviet army that if he had wanted, he could have overthrown Stalin and did prevent the ascension of Lavrenty Beria, who was head of the NKVD after the death of Stalin, simply because Lavrenty Beria was a monster of a human being. Georgi Zhukov is an example of someone who is someone uninterested in actually holding power, but who responsibly stewarded, I guess, what power he had to prevent a monster, someone 10 times worse than Stalin, from coming to power in the Soviet Union and putting the relatively tamer Nikita Khrushchev in power instead. And what's interesting to me is I learned all of this from the film Death of Stalin, which is a comedy, but apparently it's frighteningly accurate just how depraved and evil Lavrenty Beria was, and just how respected Georgi Zhukov was by the Soviet military.
Yeah, I think it's the Vietnamese embassy or the residence of the Vietnamese ambassador in Moscow was formerly Beria's residence, and they still keep unearthing human bones on the premises. He was like Hannibal Lecter, practically. Fascinating.
A pedophile Hannibal Lecter, I would add.
Yeah,
He raped girls as young as 9, 8, possibly even younger, killed them and buried them in the basement of the house. Complete, absolute, disgusting, monstrous man. Even Stalin was disgusted by him, but kept him around, I guess, to scare other people. So I think we can move on, Greg, unless there are more donations.
Yeah, let's move right along. Yeah, we have come to the end of that. Folks, if you would like to send a donation, you can send it to entropystream.live/countercurrents. And of course, we'll read your question or comment and treat you with respect. And I don't see any new DLive tokens here. So want to move on to another one of the articles from this week.
Yeah, and I think we can move on to this one is very important. Fed supported transgression by Mr. Robert Hampton, where he elucidates, where he informs us that a leading figure in white supremacist terror is a federal informant. The leader of Atomwaffen, which is they're not just white supremacists, but they're also Satanists. And apparently this is someone who has been working with the Federal Bureau of Investigation in America. And well, this is not the first time that the FBI has created clay pigeons for itself to shoot. Nazi satanic clay pigeons, I would add. I would say it's getting tiresome, but this is actually damaging not only our movement, I would say that also the alt-like, the civic nationalist types are also catching some of the flack in the form of the federal shenanigans around the Oath Keepers. Greg, you are an American, you are living under the fascist boot of the FBI. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, it didn't come as any surprise. Any group of people who are openly calling for violence and terrorism, they're working for the feds or a trap being set by the feds and so forth. And we just have to be very, very cynical about this kind of stuff. If they were initially sincere, and, you know, I guess it's possible that somebody, yes, it's definitely possible somebody could be that stupidly sincere about this kind of stuff. You can bet that by the time that the seventh person joined their group, three of them were already federal informants. The federal government has lots of well-paid people who arrive like flies to shit when there's talk of violence and terrorism and stuff like that. And they either set these things up to begin with or they quickly get inside with them. A lot of the people who are involved in this kind of stuff are people who have problems with drugs and alcohol. And especially if they get arrested for drugs, especially really serious drugs, then the feds have control over them. They can basically say, you work with us and we'll put these aside. We'll go easy on you. We'll even give you a little bit of money. And that's how they hook them. So anybody that you come across who's speaking about violence and then offers you a little snort of coke or something, run. Do not walk. Run away from these people because they're either working directly for the federal government or they're the kind of people that have been turned or will soon be turned. And you just can't afford to be around people like that. This is serious business. It's not a game. The enemy treats this as a very serious business, and we have to start treating it with equal seriousness.
Yeah, I think we've given this advice before in a previous live stream, Greg, that basically if someone offers you, hey, let's do illegal things, would you like to purchase an unlicensed firearm? Call the cops on them. Chances are this is someone who is, even if they're not a federal agent provocateur, they are someone who ought to be removed physically, if need be, from the white nationalist and dissident right movement, even if they are a moron who does drugs and tries you to entice you to criminality, you should really not be around these people. And if they are fed, you will give, you know, the FBI the black eye of having to deal with the local police who arrest them. I've thought about this scenario. If local police pick up someone and then the federal authorities have to intervene to have them released, there is a chance, however small, of this red-pilling some police officers, some local PD, as to the nature of federal law enforcement. This is probably the stream that's going to cause me and Greg to fall out, but one reason I don't like Twin Peaks, even though it is a nice show, is that it glorifies the FBI, and I think it contributes to the image the FBI has of this incorruptible institution which, you know, protects the laws and the freedoms of the people of the United States. And this is why you have this meme of the good FBI cracking down on the evil CIA or the evil whatever rogue federal agency. The face of the FBI has to stop being from Twin Peaks, Matthew McConaughey,
Dale Cooper.
Kyle MacLachlan. Yeah. Stop thinking of Kyle MacLachlan. These people are not that handsome. They're not that wholesome. They're not all American. They are evil fucks. They're evil fucks who entrap socially awkward teenagers. Like, I think there is like a diagram of the average anti-government militia floating out there. It's one fed, four informants, and one autistic teenager who now thinks he has friends. I mean, this...
That's a pretty
brilliant meme. We have to torpedo this image of good guys, which counterintelligence services throughout the world, but especially the FBI. And this is very interesting to me, again, as an outsider, as a foreigner. Here in Macedonia, in the Balkans, when you mention the counterintelligence services, if we knew someone was a member of these services, we wouldn't give them the time of day. This person would not be welcome in our homes. You know, if we saw him getting mugged or stabbed or eaten alive, we would just walk on by. If I passed by a counterintelligence agent who was on fire and I really had to pee, I would just look for a bathroom, I guess. It's a complicated way of saying I wouldn't piss on them if they were on fire. But in America, Americans adore the counterintelligence service of the United States of America, which is the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is, to me, schizophrenic. Now that I think of it, because I also grew up watching American television. The FBI, the heroic. And then I was reading all of these official documents from the American government when I started, you know, really researching the business of government when I became interested in politics. They're referring to the FBI as the counterintelligence service of the United States of America, which it is. It always has been. And when you think of counterintelligence, you think of the NKVD, you think of Lavrenti Beria. So when you think FBI, do not think of Dale Cooper. Think Lavrenti Beria with an American accent, obviously. Think rape of 8-year-old girls buried in a house in the Vietnamese ambassador's residency right now. That's what's really interesting to me. Just how Americans were propagandized into worshiping the counterintelligence service.
Yeah, I agree. The respect for the FBI has taken a huge dive under the Trump administration because their active collusion in trying to frame the president is now widely known. We see through them. We've seen what they're all about now, and we're not going to go back to being stupid about that again. So that is one thing that you can say is progress that took place under the Trump administration. A lot of these people slithered out into the open, and they were revealed not to be Machiavellian geniuses, but just a bunch of hysterical shit libs with Trump derangement syndrome and who are a bit power mad, and also sort of sleazy and petty and dumb. So the bloom is off the FBI, which is a good thing. As a dissident, ever since I became woke in the proper sense, in the dissident sense, I've known that they've been a problem. But now John Q. Public knows this as well, and that's real progress.
Gadius Maximus in the chat says, think Peter, I think his name is pronounced Strzok, although all of my instincts say Strzok, but okay.
I think it's Strzok or something. Yeah.
Strzok, yeah. Probably. I think it's Polish for stork, or Strzok. Right. I don't know.
That guy, I mean, there's this term, duper's delight, which is basically the pleasure that con artists take in deceiving people. Yeah. And that guy, he just epitomized that. Somebody talked about him. It's like, he would get this little smirk on his face, and then he'd sort of, wiggle his butt in his chair. Somebody said it was like a cat with a turd who was trying to get all the way out into the litter box, which is a phrase that will never leave my mind, as unwholesome as it is. So think of him smirking and wiggling his butt like a cat with a turd that it's trying to deposit into a litter box. That's the American FBI, folks. And that's all you need to know.
That's the American FBI as far as we know. Remember that nobody knew about Beria's transgressions until he fell from grace. And nobody knew the full extent until the opening of the Soviet archives in 1991, I believe. So as far as we know, Strzok is the worst of the FBI. But there's probably someone at the Beria level.
Oh, yeah, organization. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
We just don't know about it, and we won't know until the archives are opened. This is why they suicided Jeffrey Epstein. He probably had access to the archives. This is why it's such a well-oiled loyalty machine. I guess they all have dirt on each other. I think that's all we really have to say about the FBI and their promotion of white supremacist, Nazi, satanic terrorism. And Robert Hampton says, hopefully Sutter and Atomwaffen and the base remain a bad memory from the 2010s. Here's hoping. Unfortunately, the fact remains is that as white men become more and more alienated from society, and they will, some of them, especially some of the lower IQ, poorly socialized white men, higher impulse young white men, will drift towards these organizations. Now, we call them, Wignats derisively, but I think we should have a Wignat outreach program. We should spread this narrative of do not trust people who invite you to criminality. Hopefully it inoculates the young white men, and so they no longer participate in these schemes. Absolutely. I call everyone who's watching to spread this inoculative meme around in as much as possible.
Yeah, exactly. There was a time when vaccination wasn't a dirty word on the right. So I would like to end. We're approaching the end of 2 hours. I'd really like to talk about this piece by Jim Goad, The Thousand Year Whimper, that came out.
Let's move on to that then.
On Thursday. What are your thoughts about it? We had a whole stream with Woz and Frody about the movement malaise that people have asked about. And I think this is sort of about the malaise, although he's talking about it more generally. He's wondering, why do people seem so placid right now? What's going on? And Do you have any thoughts on that? What are your thoughts, first of all, on what GOAT has to say and just theories about the mood of the country?
That is a very interesting, because I'm reading this and it feels to me he's just commenting on how things were in the 70s, which he can remember because, you know, he still has his Category B dinosaur riding license. And today, that even though America suffered a similar defeat to Afghanistan, and even a greater one, I think the loss of the Vietnam War was an even bigger black eye and bloody nose for the American Empire than this thing in Afghanistan. It's that America rebounded in the 70s. Yeah, it took some time. It took, and I mean, the 1-2 punch of the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Nixon resignation, the Watergate scandal, really took the wind out of America. But I think, as you say yourself in the preface to The Year America Died, back then America still had some spring in its step. Right now it's an old civilization. It cannot take punches just as easily. And when punched, then I found this out, you know, the hard way. When you get punched really, really hard many times with no chance of recovery, you sort of curl into a little ball and you don't remain laying on the ground because you can't get up, but because the will to get up is no longer there. This is something I learned from combat sports, from practicing kickboxing and Krav Maga. Sometimes you get hit so hard that even if you can get up, you don't really want to. And that's my opinion on why it's like that. But there is a similar question. Maybe it's a question of a decrease of genetic quality in the American stock, and not just because of immigration, but because the even white Americans are declining in quality due to, well, the dysgenic effects of late civilization. Can you believe that?
I think this mood, though, you know, there's been a change of mood within the right since basically Trump, and I don't you can't attribute that to genetic change. We haven't had a whole new generation. We've just been reacting to changes. I think a lot of people have become disengaged with politics. They should. We've just seen that democracy is a lie. We've just seen an election blatantly stolen. And we've seen the system that was put in place by the founders to prevent things like that from happening just fail all up and down the line. And so it's kind of depressing. It's kind of depressing because we can't change the system within the system if the system is a farce, right? If they're not following the rules, but they'll punish us for not following the rules, what do you do? Well, you've just got to wait it out. I think a lot of people are sort of in a waiting mode, and they're frustrated. They would like a champion to ride forth. I frankly pray that it's not Trump. I hope the man doesn't run again, because, you know, he does a good campaign, but he wasn't a very good president. And it would be nice if we actually got somebody who was not only solid on the issues that Trump campaigned on, but actually had the political skills to make policy happen. But I think there's a reason for this. A lot of we've seen Trump removed from the stage. We've seen on the smaller scale of our movement, various talking heads removed from the stage or deplatformed from the places where we get our news and entertainment, from YouTube and things like that, from Facebook and so forth, and Twitter. And so it looks like a smaller cause. It looks smaller. But I've said this before, that's an optical illusion based on the fact that you're sitting in the audience looking at the stage and the stage is emptying out. But I'm standing on the stage looking out at the audience and reading statistics, and the audience is getting larger. And so that, to me, means that more people are tuning into our kind of discourse. And that's good, because I believe my bullshit, people. I believe the things that I say are true and helpful. And when more people want to hear it, I think that that's a sign that we're moving forward. And we've made steady, dramatic progress in the last 5 years. Since the rise of BLM, really since Trayvon Martin and then Michael Brown in 2014, we've seen a big step up. Then we saw the migrant crisis, and that was a huge step up. Then we got Trump, and that was a giant shot in the arm. Trump is gone, but we've got the migrant crisis on the American border now. We have got BLM on absolute steroids now. And the same causes have the same effects. And that means that more people are putting things together and searching for people who tell the truth about race and immigration and diversity and so forth. And that's us. That's people in our movement. So American Renaissance has been doing really well in terms of audience, and so have we. I think that's a good sign. And so the malaise, I think, is partly real. I mean, I feel it myself. I just find it painful to pay attention to day-to-day politics. I'm working on longer-term projects now. I just am attuned out of the news cycle. Doesn't mean I've become a liberal Democrat. Doesn't mean I love Big Brother and that I've thrown in the towel. And that's true of a lot of people who are just checked out for a while. They're working on their careers. They're working on their families. They're working on longer-term projects. They haven't changed their politics. They're going to be around. And when there's a chance of moving the ball forward again, they'll be here. And there are new people coming and learning this stuff. And so if you want activist opportunities, things that you can do yourself, talk to people. You know, talk to people in your own social circle. Start red-pilling people. If you're comfortable at all doing that, do it. If you're not comfortable, stick your toe in and maybe you'll get comfortable and you'll realize the water's fine. There's a huge, huge opportunity to expand our ideas, the reach of our ideas, to convert more people who are against us into people who are on our side. That's how we win. So
it is a seller's market right now.
Absolutely.
Because we are getting the triple whammy of the public developing massive skepticism towards the coronavirus measures, and especially the mandatory vaccination and vaccine passports. We are seeing the public is still reeling from the blatant election theft with regard to the 2020 American presidential election. And now Global Homo basically has given us evidence that it can bleed with the Kabul withdrawal. So we are dealing with an enemy which is coming for everything you hold dear with the vaccine passports, is completely dishonest and unscrupulous, and won't even humor your ideas on how society is governed. This is the election theft. And the final element is it is bleeding as we speak. So that's very important.
Yeah.
Because as Osama bin Laden said, people see a strong horse and they see a weak horse and naturally back the strong horse. Now, Global Homo is still a very strong horse, but it is a decrepit horse which is bleeding from a very recent wound inflicted upon it by, people say it's not just the Taliban, they have help from China and Iran and Russia. Well, good. Global Homo can still bleed. That's what we need to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And a wounded animal is extremely dangerous. Yeah. So we have to be very, very concerned. They have been defeated on the international stage, And now they're going to turn and try and they'll kick us, right? They have been trying to argue that the people like you and me are the number one threat to America, even though the country has been burned down last year by blacks and communists. We're the number one domestic terrorism threat. We know that these people are actively working to create terrorism and violence, and then they use that as an excuse to crack down. So please, you know, don't fall for this bullshit. They're very dangerous right now. They're looking for scapegoats. They're looking for distractions. They're going to come for us. We should not cooperate with them in any way. They're a dangerous animal. They're declining, but they're wounded, but they're lashing out. And that makes them even more dangerous right up to the point when they bleed out and they can't hurt us anymore, but that could take a very long time. So we should be optimistic. I have
another thing. I'm sorry. I got to interrupt you, Greg. Yeah. An interesting thing I've observed from, you know, here in Macedonia, we have now vaccine passports, and, I'm not allowed to sit in a cafe or visit a mall or go to a concert because I'm not, and I will not be vaccinated. But what I've noticed is that the propaganda here is that, oh, it's just this tiny minority which refuses to be vaccinated. But the fact of the matter is less than 20%, about 20% of Macedonians are vaccinated. And the fact of the matter is those of us who are not vaccinated, we are 80% of the population. But the propaganda is trying to convince us that we're a tiny and illiterate, uneducated minority when it's the leading physicians of the country leading the charge against mandatory vaccination. So do not let within the American and broader context allow the propaganda to gaslight you into believing you are tiny or powerless. A lot of people share our positions more now than ever. We are not, you're not a stupid or uneducated person. Both me and Greg, we are way overeducated. If I could do things all over again, I wouldn't have spent so much time in school. But you're not alone, you're not crazy, and you're not stupid. And that's, I think, the most important thing you have to keep in mind as we go forward.
Absolutely. That's very well said. My Trail of Disgrace has donated a lemon. Thank you. Kimberly has donated one diamond. Ganser Prenadier, one diamond. Which 5 Tito Perdue novels are a must read? Well, I love Tito. He's one of my favorite. He's my favorite living novelist. Absolutely. I will just give you 2 as must reads. One is The Node. It's fantastic. And the other is called Reuben. And The Node is published by Nine Banded Books, and Reuben was published by Richard Spencer with Radix. I hope it's still in print. If it isn't, I will find a way of getting it back into print, but I think it's wonderful. Gadius has written in with a Ninja Genie. Thank you very much. Great stream, gents. Nice to see Writer's Block back. And Varyag has donated one diamond as well. So, folks, we are coming to an end.
We should check entropy one last time to see donations.
Yeah, I'll hit refresh over at entropy. Yeah, that's it. Well, Nick, how do you think this went?
Well, I love how it went. I wish we could go another 2 hours, but unfortunately, you know, all sorts of alarm bells are going off that we should, I believe, end it here. We quit while we were ahead, I guess. I want to thank you, Greg, for helping me launch this new and improved writer's block, and really just inspiring me to do anything. I don't know. There would have been no end of the crazy things I would have been doing to garner attention, I guess, if I had not been set on the right path. So thank you. Good. Thank you
we've
for
had
helping
about
me launch this
people.
Show.
Yeah, we've had about 200 people between DLive and... Odyssey. So that's great. Folks, I want to remind you, tomorrow I'm doing another live stream, and we're going to start an hour later than we have in the past, and we're going to do that permanently. So it'll start at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern time. If you're in the UK, it'll start at 9. If you're in Central Europe with Nick, it'll start at 10. And the reason we're doing that is because we want to no longer stream at the same time as Patriotic Alternative. So Patriotic Alternative will be streaming for 2 hours, and then the Countercurrent stream will start right after it. And we hope that we'll carry on with some of the PA viewers and listeners. And it's an example of a rising tide floating all boats, because people are cooperating rather than competing with one another. And that's how we win. We win by cooperation. And I really want to thank Gadius, actually. I think it was Gadius who suggested that in the chat last Sunday when I was on the Patriotic Alternative Book Club. So that is a concrete example of how you listeners out there, we're listening to you. We listen to our listeners and we worked it out. And I think this is an improvement for how both groups are going to be streaming. So I think we're all going to benefit from it. So anyway, we'll be back here at this DLive channel and at this Odyssey channel tomorrow, starting at 1 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. And the guests will be F. Roger Devlin and Martin Lichtmetz. And I will also be taking your questions and comments too. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. I want to thank everyone who listened to us tonight. And I really want to thank our moderators. I want to thank Gadius Maximus. Not only is he developing ideas on how to stop competing and start cooperating, he's also moderating this chat, dominating it as always, I will say. And I want to thank everyone who donated. Everyone, even if you just listened, I want to thank you for your attention. I hope you implement some of the things Greg and I tried to impart to you here. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to post the link to the Odyssey stream in the chat. DLive is not a stable platform for us. DLive management has intimated that they're not going to tolerate us forever. And since I have planned future shows of the Writer's Block to deal with the very sensitive subject of China, how it is governed and what its people are like, I expect that we may not be long for DLive. So everyone follow us on Odyssey. If you do not have an Odyssey profile, develop one. It's a more entertaining platform. I will say that it's open. DLive is just too censorious and just too much in the moment. Odyssey keeps the replays, which is what's important. On DLive, you only get the replays for 3 days. It encourages, impulsive, high-time preference behavior, which we try to avoid. We try to be the best we can be here on the Writer's Block and in the broader Dissident Right. So until next Saturday, I'm Nicholas R. Gilvey on the Writer's Block, now streaming on the Countercurrents DLive and Odyssey's channels. And I'll see you then. Bye-bye.